This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
In 7 years, we'll have the highest percentage of Americans non-native born since the founding of the Republic.
There are some who would like us to look the other way when dealing with families at the border and not enforce the law.
If you're smuggling a child, then we're going to prosecute you.
It's a law.
And that child will be separated from you, probably, as required by law.
And when you prosecute the parents for coming in illegally, which should happen, you have to take the children away.
Hello, and welcome to TrumpCast, the show about the man who says that his new Space Force will be separate but equal to the other military service branches. Donald Trump. I'm Jacob Weisberg. You know, here on TrumpCast, we talk all the time about what it means to have a president who reflexively lies about everything, who's personally corrupt, a president who lacks a basic understanding of the constitutional order, who doesn't accept the rule of law. But over the past week, it's become clear that we're facing something even worse, an administration descending into barbarism. How else can you describe a policy of taking thousands of children hostage, separating them from their parents and holding them in cages for the sake of obtaining political leverage against the Democrats? You know, people get angry about comparisons to Nazi Germany, and no, Trump isn't Hitler and America is not Nazi Germany. But it's impossible to witness the intentional cultivation of racial hatred and the conscious infliction of cruelty against innocents and not think about Germany in the 1930s. No, children aren't being murdered, but they're being tortured, intentionally harmed by those with a duty to protect them. A group of people is being strategically dehumanized. Trump tweeted today about illegal immigrants infesting our country. Before last week, I thought that Christian Nielsen, the Secretary of Homeland Security, had some common sense, if not some moral sense. She could have resigned if she had any humanity or decency left. Instead, she defends taking children hostage while at the same time denying the obvious that such a policy exists. The odious Stephen Miller may have sold Trump this policy, but Nielsen is its public face. By staying on and saying nothing, Trump appointees like Nielsen are validating an evil that's going to tarnish the United States for generations to come. They've forfeited any benefit of the doubt we might have given them previously. They've earned, by going along, our eternal contempt. On the show today, I'll talk to a federal public defender who represents asylum seekers charged with illegal entry. But first, joining me on the line is Jean Guerrero. She's an immigration reporter for KPBS in San Diego, and she was recently inside a detention facility where some boys separated from their parents at the border are being held. Jean, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You were in a place called Casa San Diego. What's happening there? Who's there, and how do migrant children end up inside?
Right. So this is Casa San Diego is one of the facilities that's run by Southwest Key, the nonprofit that operates 27 different youth migrant shelters in California, Arizona, and Texas. It's one of the smaller shelters. It's all boys, 65 boys held in this particular shelter. So we got to take a look inside, which was very unusual because normally they want to be very, very careful about protecting the identity of these children. But at first, they just did a tour of the facility, showing us different offices, the intake room where they bring the boys and process them initially. And it's this very small room with a computer and one desk and a closet full of clothing and deodorant and razors and things like that. But we finally did get to see the bedrooms in which the boys stay. 3 to 4 boys per room. Each one gets their own twin-sized bed. Each room has its own bathroom. And near the end of the tour, we finally got to see the boys themselves. We saw them in a classroom reading, reciting right when we entered the room, they started reciting good morning in Spanish and English and Portuguese and some indigenous languages, which was kind of interesting because the whole tour had this really controlled sense about it. None of the journalists were able to bring in recording devices, not even audio equipment. In fact, when I asked if I could bring audio recording equipment, and they said no, I followed up asking them why we couldn't bring in audio recording equipment, given the fact that I imagine that their primary concern is the privacy of the kids, and we could always keep those identities anonymous. And when I followed up with that question, the Department of Health and Human Services refused to answer my question and also threatened to call off the tour. In fact, they did call it off. They called off the tour for me, and then I had to kind of backtrack and promise them that I wouldn't bring in any kind of equipment. But yes, so as I was saying, we couldn't speak to any of the children. We couldn't interview them, even off the record. That wasn't allowed. So it was very controlled, very strict rules going in. And then even during the tour, for example, we were told that we had to hold our questions until the very end. And this was a group of reporters who were very curious and had questions along the way, and they just kept telling us to wait until the end, at which point we had a very short period to ask our questions all at once. And obviously, we didn't get any in-depth answers.
Who was leading you around? Was it someone from HHS or someone who worked for this organization that runs Casa San Diego?
So there was a HHS representative there, but the person who was leading the tour was a Southwest Key official who oversees the operations of Casa San Diego. And of course, my primary question was how many of these kids have been separated from their parents. And so that was one question that they did answer. So 10% of the 65 boys there had been separated from their parents.
But so most of them not. So that's out of 65, you said, the 65 boys there, that would be 6 or 7 boys.
Exactly. So it's a small amount at this particular shelter, which is one of the smaller shelters. But I was still curious how this had changed. I wanted to see how much of an increase this represented and how this had changed operations for the shelter. But they weren't very forthcoming with that information. They weren't able to tell me how much of an increase it was. And what they wanted to focus on was this idea that they deal with traumatized children all the time. For years, they've been receiving children who are fleeing horrific gang violence at home and oftentimes have had to separate from their parents on their own or because their parents have been killed in Central America, and so they had to make the trek alone. So even those who were not separated from their families by the United States government, in some cases, had to deal with some level of family separation, saying goodbye to loved ones at home. And so what the shelter directors wanted to focus on was this idea that they're fully equipped to deal with traumatized children.
It sounds like the way you describe it, like this was a bit of a Potemkin tour. I mean, this sounds like they picked a facility which they think does pretty well, that isn't overcrowded, where most of the children weren't separated from their parents and where things have been running in an orderly way for, you know, years past before they had these few children. And they guided you around. They didn't let you talk to any of the kids, and then they didn't answer most of your questions. I mean, is that a fair description of how you experienced it?
Right, exactly. And the other unusual thing, which I didn't even realize until after the fact, we didn't get to see any of the teenage boys. All of the boys that we got to see in the classrooms and outside playing soccer were younger. I mean, I would estimate maybe under 11 or 12, but we didn't get to see any of the older boys, and I don't know why that is, but that shelter houses boys from age 6 to 17, and we didn't see any of the teenage boys.
And presumably some of these boys have sisters. Do you know where the girls are going who would have been apprehended when the boys were apprehended?
So Casa San Diego has another facility, which we didn't get to visit, that houses a few dozen girls, and several members of Congress came and had a tour of the same shelter that I visited, and they mentioned that they had chosen not to visit the girls' facility because they had been told by Southwest Key that the girls' facility was much smaller than the boys' facility and therefore wouldn't comfortably fit a large group of members of Congress. So that may be the reason that they didn't allow journalists to go look at the facility where the girls are being kept.
Are you and other journalists trying to get into other facilities? Are there ones in particular that you want to see the inside of? And in addition to journalists, who else is being let in? Is the Red Cross getting inside these facilities or other immigrant aid groups getting in? I mean, who's seeing what's really going on at these places, including some of the larger places where we've had reports of children being held in cages and crying and in conditions very different from the ones you saw?
Right. So I don't know about the Red Cross, but like I said, the members of Congress, officials who are very concerned about this family separation issue are being allowed into some of the shelters. I personally am very interested in going into the girls' facility that I mentioned, which all I know about it is that it's in Chula Vista, which is a neighborhood in the southern part of San Diego County. So I'm trying to get more information about the exact location and hoping to get permission to go inside, but it's very unlikely.
Yeah. As an immigration reporter more generally, beyond what's going on at this facility, what's your sense of how the process is holding up for asylum seekers? I mean, Jeff Sessions says that they should show up at the point of entry, the official point of entry, not try to cross in between and say, I'm here to seek asylum. What happens to people who actually follow the rules? Are they processed quickly? Are they able to get out on bail or to claim asylum as they should be able to?
So what we're seeing actually is that when people present themselves at the ports of entry, the legal way, the official way, they are often told that the ports are at capacity, that they need to come back another day. And this, for people who are in many cases desperate and fear for their lives and fear that they're being followed to the border, is really, really not an ideal scenario. And so what you see is that sometimes these individuals end up crossing the border illegally and asking for asylum that way, which I should mention, according to the Immigration and Nationality Act, people can claim asylum regardless of where they enter at the border. The law, the federal law says that even if you jump the fence, so long as you find a Border Patrol agent quickly and don't try to evade law enforcement, then you still qualify for asylum. But when Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen said that they're not turning people, they're not separating families at the ports of entry, that's false. I've covered stories where people present themselves at the ports of entry, ask for asylum, and have their children taken away from them by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The agency says that the reason they do this, the reason they separate families even when they come through legally through the ports, is for the safety of the children. Again, they highlight the safety of the children. They argue that in these cases where this happens, it's because the parents haven't provided sufficient evidence that they are the real parent of these children. But I've covered cases, and for example, there's one father from El Salvador, Jose de Marfuentes, who came with his one-year-old baby, and he brought the baby's original birth certificate as well as his Salvadoran ID. He made copies of these documents before presenting himself at the port of entry because he'd been advised by a human rights group to do so, turned these documents in to Customs and Border Protection, and was then transferred to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, where they said, where are the baby's documents? And he said, well, they're with Customs and Border Protection. And they said he didn't have enough evidence that he was the father, and so they took his baby away and sent the baby to a shelter 1,500 miles away in Texas.
My God.
And Jose,
sorry, go ahead.
Oh, and Jose remains in detention in San Diego in a detention facility. I actually followed up with Customs and Border Protection to ask them if they ever received these documents. Repeatedly, I followed up with them, and they declined to confirm or deny whether they had received these documents. They just kept pointing me back to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and ICE kept pointing me back to CBP.
And where's the baby now?
The baby was able to be reunited with his mother. So the mom crossed the border with their other son, Andre, who's 4 years old, a few weeks later. They had to come across Mexico on the infamous train La Bestia together, but the baby Mateo, the one-year-old, he started to seem very sick and dehydrated from this really exhausting weeks of traveling. And so they decided that they would split up because they didn't have enough money for bus tickets to get to the border together. So that's why Jose crossed first with the baby to try to get the baby to a safe place as soon as possible. And then when Olivia crossed a few weeks later, she finally, after weeks of bureaucracy with the Office of Refugee Resettlement, was able to get her baby. But she told me it was like, she said, I felt like a stranger trying to adopt my own son. And this has created stresses for her as well. The fact that Jose remains in detention means that she has to take care of the babies on her own. But as an asylum seeker, she's not allowed to work yet. So it's a very complicated situation.
And does that family, since you reported on this case, did they have a good claim for asylum? Where did they come from? And were they victims of some kind of violence or persecution?
Yes. So they came from El Salvador, where they had received death threats. A close friend of theirs, who was a police officer, had been killed by one of the gangs. And they had started receiving death threats because they couldn't pay the local gang, the extortion. Basically, they were being extorted and they didn't have enough money to continue paying the gang. They had this shoe business in El Salvador that was doing pretty well, and that's kind of how they got the attention of the gangs. But after a while, they just couldn't, because once the second baby was born, it was just too much to continue paying these gang fees that are required of so many people in El Salvador. And so they decided to run away to try to save their children's lives.
Jean, it sounds like you're doing a better job controlling your rage about this policy than I am. What's it like reporting on this day after day? I mean, it must just be brutal seeing these heart-rending stories.
There's just such a denial of the reality happening by the Trump administration that you want to be, you just feel this tremendous sense of responsibility to clarify for the public what's really going on and to put a human face to these stories. You try to bring attention to the stories of people who are truly, truly in a difficult situation and have been separated from their kids, which is just creating more trauma for everyone involved. And this isn't something I'm just saying, that the American Pediatrics Association, various medical and psychiatric associations have come out and said that this policy of family separation can cause permanent psychological damage to children. As a journalist, you feel a real responsibility to show what's happening and to make sure you get it right.
I've been speaking to Jean Guerrero. She's an immigration reporter at KPBS in San Diego. Jean, thanks for talking to me.
Thanks so much.
We'll be back with more TrumpCast in a moment.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Eric, to get your name right, I actually want to pronounce your name right. It's Eric Hanchu?
It's Eric Hanchu.
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 Got it.
I'm glad we asked.
Yes.
Joining me on the line is Eric Hanchu. He's an assistant federal public defender for the Western District of Texas in El Paso. Eric, thanks for joining us on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Can you just tell me where you are right now, what your office looks like?
So our office, we're in downtown El Paso. I'm sitting at my desk looking out the window at the detention facility where all of our separated parents are being held right now.
Is you're looking out the window at the detention facility?
Yes, sir. I can look at it straight out my window. It's a large, fairly windowless, cement-looking building. It's you can look from our office at the courthouse and at the jail. So they're all within basically the same block.
Who's in that detention facility as far as we know?
A lot of moms and dads that have had their children taken by immigration.
And are these are families that crossed the border, attempted to cross the border near El Paso in western Texas along the Rio Grande and were apprehended there?
Yes, that's correct. So these are families, usually parent and child, that were found and arrested along the U.S.-Mexico border here in the, you know, El Paso area, I would call it. And then they were, after their arrest, the parent was taken into custody for a federal criminal prosecution, which is what we represent and defend the parent for. And the child was taken into the custody of the ORR, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, another executive branch.
And that's part of the Department of Health and Human Services, whereas the Border Patrol, who you're dealing with on behalf of the parents, is DHS. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
So where the parents are across the street from you, your clients, where are their children being sent?
There's the question everybody would like to know the answer to, most particularly their parents and my clients. We don't know. Right now, the process is essentially to start calling the ORR number, asking the whereabouts of our client's child. Usually we're told they're safe somewhere in the United States. ORR, for the large part, has refused to provide any significant details as to where specifically that location is. It's not until much later in this process that there's even any word about, for example, a city and or a particular home or facility. So right now, the answer to most of our clients is we don't know because they won't tell us.
And when they're trying to track their children, what do they have? Is the child given an identification number? Do they have a claim check? I mean, what is the connection to try to track them down?
And there's another huge problem, which is there appears to be no coherent policy by DHS, ORR, Department of Justice, whichever executive group you want to talk about, as to what it is they provide or not to these parents. It runs the gamut from anecdotally, from, you know, being in the field down here representing these folks, that some get absolutely nothing. Others have been, you know, told to call numbers. Others have been given some paperwork about the now immigration proceeding that their child will be a participant in. But there is no clear, straight answer to this.
And is your job as a public defender to help them find their children, or is it simply and only to defend them on the criminal charges related to crossing the border?
Well, I mean, our appointment in this case is to represent our client in the federal criminal proceedings. But as a component of that includes issues, for example, such as bond. And, you know, that's a big issue that's arisen here in El Paso, which is, you know, our office asking on behalf of our clients for our clients, the parents of these children, to be able to be out on bond so that they can actually have a realistic chance of trying to locate, console, and hopefully reunite with their child. So we have to gather that information because that's something that we present to the court and the court's considerations of their criminal case, for example, the bond. So it is crossed over into all proceedings.
Have you been able to get bail for any of your clients, for many of your clients?
Yeah, you know, we've had some success. There are a number of different magistrate judges here in El Paso, but one particular judge here, Judge Miguel Torres, just a few weeks ago started granting bonds in, you know, in each case as a case by case. But for example, I had three cases with separated parents that he granted a bond. Now, the unfortunate part is that the government, meaning the U.S. Attorney's Office, immediately appealed and ask the higher level courts to stay the bond. So at this point, our clients are in a waiting game, still in jail, until the next level of courts decide whether that Judge Torres decision was correct.
What does the government want to happen in these cases? Presumably, they intend for these people to be deported, I guess, together or separately with their children. But what consequence are they looking for the crime of border crossing?
Oh, they don't oppose what most all these individuals get, which would be time served. So you know, they're not necessarily going to court and asking for a bunch of time. It's that they are getting these criminal convictions and felony convictions at it.
Conviction, deporting. So if they cross the border again, then presumably
right. Now, instead of the exposure being, you know, for a person with no prior history and no criminal history, you know, a range of punishment of 0 to 6 months, meaning usually something like time served or probation, upon return, you know, that escalates. You're talking multiples of 3 or 4 times that type of exposure for coming back here. Because now when you come back illegally as a previously deported felon, the punishment range has jumped. They don't talk about months. It can reach years.
Eric, before the zero tolerance policy, these weren't criminal suits necessarily. I mean, crossing the border illegally was treated as a civil infraction, not a criminal offense, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's correct to say that the federal criminal law of illegal reentry has existed for years. That has existed. What is different now is that prior to these new policies, individuals of which most of these separated parents fall into this group that had no prior criminal history in the United States and limited immigration contact, meaning they had come here once or twice in the past and had been processed through immigration proceedings, would not be what I call felonized. They would not be put into federal criminal prosecutions like they are now. So yes, you know, a year ago, these individuals would never have met me because they would never have been in federal criminal prosecution proceedings.
So tell me, how do you get assigned these cases? And then what's the process in each case? How do you meet the clients? What happens?
Okay, so the initial start of this whole process that gets the wheel going is our clients, well, before they're our client, they show up in federal criminal court, and a judge makes a determination about appointments of counsel. They appoint, in a large number of cases, our office, the Office of Federal Public Defender, these cases. Our office each day gets, you know, these cases, takes them in, and then assigns them out to the various, like myself, assistant federal public defenders. We're assigned the case, and then the personal part starts, which is, like I said earlier, you walk out the door and turn the corner and go meet the human being. You go meet that person at the jail. And, you know, this whole process, this whole new policy has really changed that relationship. Instead of going there and meeting, you know, a client whose questions are about, you know, what time am I looking at? What do the charges mean? You know, how's the judge in front of me? You know, the typical questions that, you know, someone being charged with a federal crime would ask their lawyer. The conversation now is it's tragic. It's a conversation of a parent explaining what happened to them out in the field, that their child was taken, and then the series of questions that any parent would ask: Where is my boy? Where is my girl? Where are they taking them? When will I see them? Are they going to be okay? Are they going to send me back to my home country with them? Are they going to send me without them? You know, that's the conversation now in the face to face with these parents.
And you're speaking to them in Spanish, I assume.
Yeah, so we go over and, you know, we translate for anyone that's obviously not you know, an English speaker and explain all that to them.
As a public defender, do you see these cases through from arraignment to deportation or final disposition, or do you hand it over at some point to somebody else?
Okay, so our as the federal criminal defense attorneys in this case, and the public defender in particular, our appointment is to represent them in the criminal proceeding. So we, you know, from the initial in the case when we're appointed till the ultimate disposition, which typically in federal criminal cases, at least here in El Paso, is usually a sentencing, the occasional, you know, not guilties or acquittals. But once that criminal case ends, that's the end of our appointment. And then the individual is, when they've completed, if they've been sentenced, their federal sentence, once they complete that sentence is when they then proceed to the immigration court or proceedings. And that's where discussions of, you know, removal, deportation, seeking relief and all that begins.
I mean, I can only imagine the way, as you describe it, the distress of these parents who, as you say, would have just one question, which is, where are my children and what's happening to them? I mean, this must take a psychic toll on you and the other public defenders. I mean, how do you deal with this, having people in this horrendous inhuman situation and doing that all day, every day.
Yeah, it's hard. You know, I'm a father myself, and you know, I've been used to this job where you go in and you deal with, you know, stressful situations and meeting, you know, a stranger and having to try to make a relationship as quickly as possible with them, and tell them tough things. But I've never in all the years of doing this, had to repeatedly tell a client who's a parent that I'm sorry, that I can't believe that this country did this to you and your child. And two, most horrifically, I don't have any good concrete answers to what you care about, which is exactly where your child is and how and when will you be with them. And that's something that, you know, is difficult. I mean, as any parent, any human being can imagine, having to share that to somebody when that person rightfully believes, you know, the only person out there that they know at that point in time is whose job it is to help them and educate them and give them legal advice. And we're left with answerless in many instances because of, you know, what immigration has done and what they've failed to do and how they've failed to explain to anyone what exactly this process is, when it ends, how it ends, and all those other things that people want to know, that parents want to know.
And what percentage of them would you say came planning to claim asylum or are escaping political persecution or gang violence or some classic asylum scenario?
You know, that's one of the tricky parts of putting a finger on that, because and this is where this is also very difficult, is that there's two distinct proceedings, right? You've got the criminal prosecution, of which we are the defenders for these folks, and then there will be the immigration proceedings, which they will ultimately at some point end up in. It's at those proceedings typically that they are asserting and making those types of claims for what we would call relief, right? Like asylum, as you mentioned. They're intertwined in the sense of, you know, that's part of figuring out, you know, how they made their way here. But how and if and when they make those claims and exactly how they make them becomes a, you know, an issue with immigration.
I mean, you can't make an asylum claim after you've been deported. Do they have the ability to assert that in this initial proceeding?
So if the process works as it should, when they arrive there at immigration after completing their federal criminal case, normally meaning they completed their sentence, they're supposed to be provided an opportunity there to, you know, make claims of credible fears and the such, those types of things. You know, as a federal defender, you meet every week. I meet new people. Before this, you know, thankfully it wasn't parents with their kids taken. But you meet people, and lots of these cases along the border and federal court have always been about, you know, illegal immigration and the such. And when you hear the stories of these individuals about why, where they came from, why they left, why they risked their liberty, why they risked their safety, you know, all of these considerations, what we, I think, in the United States have a hard time understanding is the actual reality of the day-to-day life for so many of these individuals, which includes abject poverty. And that just touches the tip. I mean, that doesn't get into violence, gangs, cartels, healthcare. I mean, these are all the issues. You know, we have a healthcare debate in our country when we talk about what insurance covers and not. This is a healthcare debate about the fact that there is nothing. You are going to die from your maladies unless you escape. So, you know, this is the reality that I think people miss when they're saying, oh, you know, how it's their fault because, you know, they brought their child here. They risk, you know, you hear this from some of the government lawyers arguing about these cases, about the fact that, you know, they made the choice and they brought their child here and the dangers and stuff. Well, you know, ask yourself what you would do as a parent if that was your reality where you lived.
Eric, I can hear how passionate you are about defending these people. Beyond defending your clients, what are you and, I don't know, the other public defenders in your office talking about? What can you do about it beyond just fighting these cases one by one?
Well, I think as a collective, you know, we've taken an effort at the directive of our fearless leader, Maureen Franco. She's the defender for the Western District. And we are participating in outreach, you know, and interviews just like this, and reaching out to any and all immigration resources, civil rights groups, to get out the truth, which is what is happening to these folks in the field, so that, you know, when people in the American public sphere, you know, hear the arguments, they also hear the facts, you know, that they hear about what is happening to, you know, these individuals, these human beings. So that's what we're doing. We're trying to make sure that everybody, you know, understands that this is the plight, this is the consequence of, you know, the actions that are being taken. And hopefully, you know, with that education, people can make the decisions that are more informed.
Eric, I want to speak for my listeners here. I know they'd want to thank you for the work you're doing defending people who have no other defense. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate you all putting this information out for people to listen to. Thank you very much for all that.
Thanks again. I hope we'll speak to you again, and good luck.
All right. Thank you. Have a great day.
And that's our show for today. If you're still with us, you must be getting something out of it. We'd really appreciate if you'd go to Apple Podcasts and give us a rating and review. It helps others discover the show. Trumpcast is produced by Jason DeLeon. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Thanks for listening to Trumpcast.